Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
So hey folks, what's coming up here is an edition of The Weeds that I did with Darren Jane live at the Texas Tribune Fest in Austin, Texas. You know, our producer, Jeff, he tells me this is the best audio we've gotten from a live show yet. So I think you're really going to enjoy that crisp, clear sound.
Hi, welcome to another episode of The Weeds, a live episode of The Weeds here at the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin, Texas. I'm Matthew Iglesias. I'm here with Jane Costin and Dara Lynn from ProPublica. We're really excited to be here. It's our second year at Texas Tribune Festival. Last year, I think we recorded a really great episode.
The best episode The Weeds has ever done.
But then it didn't get recorded. But this year, we are hoping that the audio gods and Walmart will shine their blessings upon us.
I do need everyone in this room to promise that if it turns out the audio of this episode is lost, you will tell all of your friends and colleagues that we delivered the most brilliant
Make
hour-long
it sound
disposition
like the, like on the lost impeachment Led Zeppelin concert, like.
And you now no longer need to hear anything else about it.
It's so good. So obviously there's a big politics story today having something to do with Ukraine. Unfortunately, we need to come up with something that will work as a recording several days from now. And also, we were on airplanes all day and don't actually know what's happening.
Yes. And also, while we do promise a Q&A at the end, we do not want a situation where you guys have to be following on your phones to tell us what is happening as the time progresses.
So Trump won't be impeached this afternoon, I think.
I mean, but we probably not.
We wanted to talk about something which is at the intersection, this is The Weeds, of real boring policy stuff and Trump antics. And that is homelessness,
right,
where it seems that the president went to Los Angeles and got mad.
Yes. Not necessarily in that order.
So I think that to start out, I think that we should talk. There are two ways that I think that we should talk about homelessness. So there's the actual problem of homelessness. And then there's Trump whining because he thinks that the state of California is plotting against him. And so he will point out homelessness existing in large cities within California and other places to be mean. And also to make the point that homeless people, he does not particularly think about homeless Americans. He is thinking about the wealthy people that homeless people are somehow sometimes in front of or around or next to. Or
Which,
behind.
In fairness to Donald Trump, it is not like Donald Trump is the first person in the history of urbanized living to look at homelessness as a problem primarily of optics, right?
Exactly. Now, just for some numbers, in the state of Texas, there are 25,000 people experiencing homelessness right now, and about 3,400 of those are experiencing what we call chronic homelessness. And chronic homelessness is if you have experienced homelessness for longer than a year, generally linked to some sort of chronic condition, whether it be mental illness or addiction. And so when we're thinking about homelessness, there are different types of homelessness. There's situational homelessness, like, you know, there was a sudden death in the family and you can no longer afford the rent. And so that, you know, it's a homelessness that's spurred on by a specific event. There's episodic or cyclical homelessness. You are dealing with an addiction to heroin, you get clean, you get housing, you relapse, you lose your housing because a lot of sober living situations, for understandable reasons, do not permit people who are still using to live within those housing facilities. And then, as I said, there's chronic homelessness, which is kind of what I think a lot of people think of when they think of homelessness, of people who are living on the streets or in their cars for years and years. But what we've been seeing recently is a rise in the number of working homeless people. And so, you know, 22% of homeless single adults are employed, 25% of adults within homeless families, and keep in mind, this is a family unit, are employed. And so you're seeing a number of people, you know, if you go to any city in Austin or Dallas or elsewhere, you see people who are working, living out of their cars, often in the parking lots of the place where they might work. And sometimes, you know, I was doing some research for this episode, and there were situations in which people got permission from their jobs to sleep in their car in the parking lot of where they worked. And so I think it's important, you know, we'll talk about some of the challenges to addressing homelessness, which get at, you know, Matt's favorite thing in the entire world, housing.
Sure.
But also, I think that the basic, and I'm glad, Dara, that you made this point, because a lot of it does turn into kind of the moment at which Trumpiness and lefty NIMBYism come together. The idea that homelessness, you know, when you are protesting against the building of a homeless shelter because it might put shade over your park, I think that we've got a problem here. Yeah. And so I think that's why I thought it was such an important issue to talk about, because right now the administration keeps saying things about like encampments. And, you know, when the administration or when authorities talk about cleaning up homeless encampments, they don't mean like taking the homeless people and providing them with homes. They mean like, let's get rid of the tents and they'll figure it out from there. So right. I thought it was time that we actually get into the actual issues behind homelessness in America and some of the actual possible solutions.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, definitely the politics and policy frameworks, as you've identified them, are like, they're fairly independent, right? There really have been changes to the homeless population. And at the same time, thinking of homelessness as a matter of encampments, as a matter of, you know, unsightliness, and in defense to, you know, like to be fair to NIMBYs, it's not just a, I don't want this homeless shelter, you know, getting in the way of my view. It can also be a, I am worried about the stability of my neighborhood. I am worried about crime. I am worried about drugs. I am worried about who I am going to have to interact with on my way to and from work, which like is not a non-zero concern. That said, that's a concern that associates homelessness with the kind of chronic mental illness, drug use. You have to have something else going on in your life in order to be homeless that might have been true to some extent a decade ago and is now less true as the working homeless become more of a thing. And so we have at the same time, like a shift in the kind of policy reality of homelessness and a rise in political salience from both the NIMBY left as cities become more gentrified and as people feel a little bit more empowered in their recently adopted cities to start tagging things on social media and saying, hey, city government, like, why are these people just out here? This seems bad. This seems dangerous. You should fix this.
It is enraging every time.
And with Fox
that
News kind of weaponizing some of these visuals of tents, you know, not necessarily to say bad faith, but certainly for people who otherwise are not going to encounter tent cities in San Francisco.
I'm going to say it's kind of bad faith. I think we can say, I think that the Jesse Waters discussing homelessness is not exactly, you know, I'm okay with saying that's in bad faith.
Which is the thing that's interesting, right, is that you can have a sort of productive equilibrium on this. And I think we did. I mean, starting when George W. Bush was president, there was a big movement from the federal government to sort of promulgate some ideas that were called housing first as a way to address chronic homelessness. And like the basic idea of that is, right, like the old thinking had been, okay, if you are living on the streets and you're addicted and you don't have a job, what you need to do is like get clean first, then we can find some kind of sober arrangement for you. We can help you get a job. Then you get a job. And now that you're sober and employed, you've shown that you're like worthy for social support and we're going to try to help you out. And Housing First like turned that on its head. And it said, look, we have people who are living on the streets. They are generating a lot of calls to the police. They are going in and out of emergency rooms when the weather gets really bad or when they get sick. We're spending tons of money on what's actually a relatively small fraction of the total people experiencing homelessness. And if we can just
get you like an apartment and put you there. That is simpler. It's better for you, but also cheaper for the city. And then we can bring services to you. If you say, I would like to get treatment, you can provide it to somebody who now at least has a stable address, right? You can apply for jobs. You have an address. And homelessness started to go down, right? And this, like, it leveraged the fact that, like, people living in urban areas would rather that, like, their parks be parks rather than, sleeping accommodations. But also the people sleeping in the parks would rather have sleeping accommodations, right? So it was a sort of a productive paradigm. And I think the problem that you're starting to see, particularly in the big West Coast cities, is that the overall quantity of housing has just become so scarce that, like, humane efforts, like, Los Angeles has actually put a lot of money into homelessness services, but the number of people experiencing homelessness is going up anyway because the price of housing is accelerating so much. And that's when you tip over into, like, we got to just round them up.
Right. And I think it's important, you know, I try to differentiate about, like, different types of homelessness, but there's also, understandably, different types of homeless people. And the people who you move to Los Angeles because you got a job, and how, you know, your housing is a little tenuous and you lose your job, that's a different situation than someone who is struggling with an addiction or who has been on the streets for 15 to 20 years. And so a lot of the resources that are available, for example, in DC, there have been some efforts to expand resources availability to the kind of the working homeless. But if you are a recently homeless person, you don't want to go to a shelter because shelters are dangerous. The safest place for you to be is probably in your car or in whatever you can find to stay in. And so it's really important because that's kind of the new story. There's a new homelessness. And I think that that's part of the increase. It's not just the concerns about visibility. It's about who is becoming homeless as well.
Right. And I actually, like, it's not, in addition to there are legitimate reasons why you might not want to go to a shelter, like, if a shelter has limited space and is doing triage, I don't know if there is, and I'm going to put this in show notes, which is another way of saying everyone in this room is in worse shape than everyone who is not in this room and gets to click on the link. But the New Republic had a really excellent story last month on the rise of the working homeless. And the protagonist in that story, who's a working mother who lost the apartment that she and her family were renting because it got condemned due to exposed wiring issues. There's a scene when she's doing intake at, like, a service shelter. And she's like, no, you don't understand. I've never done drugs. I don't drink alcohol. Like, I work. I've been working. This is not why we're here. We're here because we can't find a place to live. And at the end of the intake, she's told that her, like, needs score isn't high enough probably to qualify for services, because when you only have limited resources and you need to be taking care of the highest need people first, someone who, like, has family members whose couches they're all bouncing between, even if they know their luck is about to run out on that count, and who does have a job and, like, has clearly demonstrated the ability to live independently, may not be the first place that you want to, that you can spend that money if you're trying to look at highest need first. Which actually brings me to, like, a historical question, because I personally, in the paradigm that I had before doing research for this episode, in which I totally thought was still thinking of homelessness as, like, as another epiphenomenon of, like, mental health and drug issues in many cases, was tying it to the post-institutionalization paradigm, right? In the same way that, like, to a large extent, the current jail crisis in America is the result of police having to be first responders for people who there is no institutional way to deal with them anymore, because we used to just stick people in asylums and that wasn't a very good idea and nobody bothered to come up with a better solution. Is that something where, like, either because that was a source of housing supply or because that was something that now other service providers need to deal with, is that, like, did deinstitutionalization also, like, cause the kind of problem in housing policy that opposed in jail policy?
But my understanding of that is that it did historically, that in the 1980s, you saw an increase in the number, particularly of chronically homeless people who had sort of multiple overlapping addiction and mental health issues, largely because there had been both a deinstitutionalization and also just a disinvestment in these kind of healthcare programs in a lot of places that combined with a very severe recession in 1982 to sort of create, like, the modern homelessness paradigm.
Yeah.
But for 15 years or so, at the beginning of the 21st century, we had really cut away at that very substantially. And what you're seeing now, I mean, the point of like the rise of working homelessness, right, is that what you're seeing is that a much larger share of people who, rather than it being that they're like having trouble functioning in the labor market, it's that like earnings don't buy you housing in everywhere. I mean, we're here in Austin, and you know, this is exactly the kind of city where economic growth, you know, is proving to be, it's like the tide rises, but not all boats quite lift fast enough.
Yeah.
And the housing situation can actually get worse, right? And if you look at the cities that are having the biggest homelessness problems right now, it's like Seattle, San Francisco. It's not cities that are having the hardest, it's not places that have the weakest economies or the places that have the hardest time providing services to people. It's many times the places that have the hottest economies. And so people with low-wage jobs just can't afford a place to live there, and sort of has to be addressed on like just like the conventional housing side. Like you have to build more apartments.
Right. No, the reason that I was thinking about institutionalization in particular is because in the Trumpian politics of this, it's very interesting that this has come up at the same time that the president appears to be really invested in the response to mass shootings is involuntary commitment.
Yes.
Right? Right. Like this is, there is kind of a real hardening, at least in the mind of, you know, Donald J. Trump, that there are just some people who should be like kept out of society and this will solve things. And it's kind of interesting to read or to read about, to be clear, I have not read this report. The president actually put out, well, the White House put out a Council of Economic Advisors report on homelessness recently, presumably tied to the president's recent interest in going after the state of California for this. But it's a pretty standard conservative document that at one point actually says, if you take a housing first approach, you'll clear up beds and shelters. Shelters will have to compete to fill those beds, and so will raise the quality of their services. And if you raise the quality of shelter services, it will make homelessness rise again.
Yeah, it's
which is
wild.
Very impressive as a feat of logic, and makes sense if you believe that there are some people who just really are determined to be antisocial, right?
Right.
But like if you see homeownership as an important part of being in society, just like if you see not killing a lot of people as an important part of being in society, there are some people who are just characterologically unable to live that way, and that therefore making it hard for them to live any other way is the most important thing.
And there are a lot of things wrong with that logic.
Yes.
On just a host of different perspectives.
Yeah, no, and I don't mean to like take away from actual solutions into like the Trump
model. No, but I think it's worth talking about, because I think that the mental health piece of this and the idea of, you know, like, why don't, I've seen this in a host of conservative publications that like, there used to be this time in which we could put these people away somewhere. And then Geraldo Rivera did this television program and then we stopped doing that. There was an infamous Geraldo Rivera documentary about a mental health facility that was horrifying. And he was very young. And that basically is how he got the fame that he has now. But I think that one, there's an understanding of how mental illness interreacts with homelessness and violence that is not necessarily based on
science,
facts. So I think that that's worth noting as well. Also, because the proportion of homeless, you know, one, pulling homeless people is hard for understandable reasons. But the proportion of people who are chronically homeless, who are dealing with severe enough mental health issues that you even institutionalization of some sort, which don't even, like, we can't even get into just that issue, because that there's, you know, one of the reasons why deinstitutionalization happened was because advocates for people living with mental illness were like, you know, schizophrenia, you can medicate schizophrenia. This is something that mental illness is something that millions of people live with every single day and are able to be part of society in whatever way they see fit. And, you know, it doesn't require being hospitalized. But also, most homeless people, most homeless Americans, and I want to be very clear, because sometimes we talk about the homeless as if it's like an issue we need to face. Like we need to deal with like the Saudis and Ukraine and the homeless. No, like these are our neighbors. And for a lot of people, those, you know, Those are the people who come to go to church with us. These are people living in our communities. And the vast majority of them are not dealing with the types of severe mental illness that Donald Trump seems to think that should require an automatic 3130 hold for the rest of your life.
Well, and, you know, this is not the first time either that you see a sort of a disjoint between, like, what the president seems to think and what the president's team seems to think, right?
Story,
I mean, right. I mean, so that CEA report, if you read it, I mean, it's basically an effort to justify why you shouldn't spend any more money on a homelessness problem, right? Because a natural thing many people, particularly in a liberal state or city, might think is, well, this is a social problem. We should spend more money on programs for it.
Right, because if you believe that homelessness is the problem, and this is, I think, another issue with, like, gauging public opinion and public salience on this, right? Some people who say that homelessness is a crisis are saying the homeless are the problem. And some people are saying these people need houses.
Right. Well, but so the report, you know, it goes through two things. And one, which I think is right, is it talks about why is this a particularly severe problem in California? And it's not because California is an unusually stingy state. It's because California is an unusually difficult state to get house building permits, right? So that's, like, I think, like, a sound argument. And then there's this sort of galaxy brain argument that, like, trying to help people makes things worse because they're out quitting, and that maybe if the cops hassle people more, they will, like, miraculously decide they should get a house somewhere.
Which has the convenient fringe benefit of, because Donald Trump is less averse to spending money, at least on the things he likes, than his team is, you can reach this nice little consensus where it's okay to spend money if you're, like, you want to build a federal warehouse to put homeless people in, because at least you're not making it easier for them to be homeless.
At least it's bad, right. And so Trump, I mean, so I grew up in New York in the 80s, and I always feel like I understand where Trump is coming from, because we're coming from the same place. And I think he's participating in a debate that I remember from when Ed Koch and David Dinkins were mayor. And this was about, you know, courts had sort of put restrictions on the ability of the city to tell people, like, no, you can't be out here living on the streets, right? And so the city government's view for a long time was, like, look, like, our hands are tied here. Like, we would like to address these quality of life problems that you, the normal citizen of New York, are experiencing. We would like to tell people they can't be napping in the libraries, right? Stuff like that. And eventually, you know, Giuliani came in as mayor, and, you know, some different judges were around, and they got tough on the behavior of people experiencing homelessness, right? So there was this famous thing about squeegee men. This was, like, by, you know, there'd be, like, big traffic jams by the bridges and tunnels on Manhattan. So people would come and do your windshield and, you know, kind of shake you down for money, right? And so Giuliani dispatched police officers to, like, not take care of murders, but to hassle the squeegee guys.
Yes. Broken windows policing.
Well, it was a big thing. You know, I mean, there was, like, there was a crime control theory of broken windows policing, but there was also a middle-class lifestyle politics, right? Where, like, I mean, I remember it was, like, white middle-class New Yorkers were not, in fact, being murdered at high rates, even when the murder rate was high, but we were being hit up for money by squeegee men at high rates, right? So he was directly addressing an issue that impinged on the lives of his constituency there with that, right? And this has, I think, actually very little to do with contemporary homelessness issues. But, you know, Trump is not the kind of guy to, like, fire up the Urban Institute's report on, like, what is driving these trends and stuff like that. So he just goes back to the well. He's like, I remember hearing a lot about homelessness in the 80s. And I remember what I thought about it then. I'm hearing about it again now. So I'm going to, like, say the same thing
again.
Right.
It's an attitudinal similarity, because his, you know, even when he tweets about it, it's about, like, these people are outside of our beautiful buildings and outside of, like, you know, our wealthiest citizens.
It reduces the prestige of Los Angeles.
Yes, which I'm like, well, it's probably not too fucking hot for homeless people either. So,
I mean, they're not having a great time.
I agree with you that it's divorced from the policy reality, but it does strike me that the way in which it has become a politically salient issue is still very similar, right? Because the other thing about the working homeless is that they are much less visible than the chronic homeless.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Either because they do have the like family connections to be like sharing couches, which as we've discussed on this podcast in the past, one of the big problems with like the racial wealth gap is the amount of stress that it puts on the family members who do have homes to then, you know, be part of that kin network, or because they're able to stay in their cars in the parking lot of their office. Like the way that the homeless population is counted is a shelter and street count. It's not a knocking on the windows of cars at night in January saying, is there anyone in there?
Right.
So both like in the literal policy sense and in the, if you think of homelessness as something that you are going to encounter as someone walking through an urban environment, you're dealing with the chronic homeless. And so I think that the kind of NIMBY gentrifier encounter with the homelessness problem as it exists, even though it's a different problem, is still very similar. And that kind of like, you know, obviously, I don't think anyone who is a podcast host of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network has a direct line to Donald Trump and is going to change Donald Trump's mind. But I do suspect that many of that our listeners are probably more likely to be dealing with this kind of in the context of, you know, their own metropolitan area politics. And so, like, I don't know, what is the way to address this in the NIMBY framework? Or, you know, NIMBY, I think NIMBY and gentrifier are two different populations in general that here are meaning the same thing. Insofar as it's a concern mostly with the presence of homeless people in your daily life.
You have to make a Section 8 entitlement program. I mean, I think that's like, I mean, the number one biggest thing, right, is like, so we have, if you fall below a certain income threshold, right, like you get Medicaid. If you are a school-aged child, you get to go to public school. If you fall beneath a certain income threshold, you get food stamps. Housing assistance is not structured that way, right? And in most of the country, you could take care of this problem like that.
Yeah, like, do you want to talk about Salt Lake City, dude?
By changing this, Salt Lake City, well, this is not exactly what they did, right? But like Utah had like one of the most successful housing first ventures. And that's because the ambient background of housing in Salt Lake City is pretty affordable, right? So then they could focus resources on the minority of people who did have complicated social service needs. And then it was fairly easy to create transitional housing for other people. Because the typical scenario that will arise for working people is, you know, you're in a relationship. And so you have two people who are splitting the rent. And then for whatever reason, like that breaks up suddenly. And particularly if that happens at also the same time you get sick or your car breaks down, right? You have like just two pieces of bad luck hit in the same month. And then you can't afford a place. You had to leave your place. You can't get a new place. And now you're out, right? And if housing is generally affordable, you can sort of create like a social service trampoline to like catch people. And then they just get a little bit more money and they can go get a place, right? And you have very serious problems though in places where apartments are just extremely expensive. It has become hard. So like Los Angeles has really invested a lot of money in trying to do social services, but the number of people who can't afford the rent in Los Angeles is growing faster than they can grow the social services. And you have to have houses.
Right.
Anyway, I like to talk about that.
Yeah. And I think that it's important also because I think chronic homelessness is probably, you know, there are a lot of cities right now where their solution in some part to chronic homelessness is putting homeless people on buses and then busing them out of the city and then considering the problem to be solved. That if we could not do that, that would be great. But I also think like there need to be separate solutions in my mind for there is, you know, as we said, there's kind of episodic homelessness. Cyclical homelessness, where it's kind of, you know, for example, if you are living in a sober living facility, but you are still friends with people who still use, and you are like, you know, my friend is like living on the streets right now. I really want them to come stay with me. I know that they're still using, but I'm sure it's going to be fine. It's not going to be fine. The sober living facility will say, you are both now out. And so that ruins a lot of built up stability. And especially in environments in which like, you're asking people to choose between the community they continue to know whether or not that community is good for them, it is still the existing community. Or you're going to a sober living facility where a lot of times sober living facilities have really stringent, understandably stringent rules, not just on drug use, but on your basic activities. That is a slightly, that challenge, the issues facing working homeless people and the issues facing those kind of episodic kind of, a crisis happens and that's how homelessness results. That's different from chronic homelessness. But because in urban environments, if I'm walking in downtown, in Chinatown or down Connecticut Avenue in DC, I am likely not seeing the working homeless. I am seeing chronically homeless people.
Right.
And I think that visual is a different issue.
It can be very easy. I think that there are lots of issues where the need for a policy response can trump any efforts to address, what can individuals do? What can civil society institutions do? And, I joked with Matt before this episode that it turns out that my feelings about homelessness have a strong Marianne Williamson streak to them, which is, not really true. We are not going to levitate the tents out of San Francisco. But I do think, I was raised assuming that when you go to a hotel, of course, you're going to take the samples of the hair products and such, because once a year, either the school or the synagogue is going to hold a drive for people who need to use those hygiene products. And so I've definitely been interested as I've seen hotels move to dispensers for environmental reasons about the kind of downflow effects of that. It's always seemed to me that helping the homeless is one of those easy apolitical ways to help humans. It's not quite as apolitical as helping puppies or sick kids, but it's definitely on that spectrum of charities and volunteer things that no one is going to be mad at you if you do. And those are often filling immediate needs that, while not going to solve the problem, are in fact shared between chronic and working. Everybody is going to need access to hygiene. Everybody is going to need access to, a place where they can get a good hot meal, where they're, where they can get their medical needs taken care of, that kind of thing.
One
and so
other
there
thing
really
I,
is
yeah.
kind of a, if your concern is that the people in your community are making you feel less safe, you should probably start with, and I say this as someone who literally lives in a gentrifying neighborhood and has not done any volunteering since they moved to the District of Columbia. But I think it's worth thinking about if there are people in your community, first and foremost, what obligation does that put on you?
I would also note that, and another very, very quickly, that if you're thinking about things to do, I know some of my church, for example, does an ID ministry. Because if you'll remember, the first day at whatever job you took, you had to fill out a bunch of forms. And a lot of those forms involved photocopying your passport or your state ID or your driver's license, and you need your social security number. If you're chronically homeless, where is your social security card? Do you have one? Do you know where it is? Do you have a pass? You probably don't have a passport. So making sure that people have the documents they need to even begin to access social services is a really great start. And now, Matt, you can say the thought that you've had.
I want to do an elegant pivot
to
moral foundations.
Damn it. I'm sorry.
Wow. Sorry, Matt.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees. And their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
That brings us to our white paper. The paper is from the American Journal of Political Science. It's Ideology Justifies Morality. Political beliefs predict moral foundations. And so this paper used moral foundations theory, MFT. I'm looking off my phone so I do not get these words wrong and get angry emails from anyone.
You're gonna get angry emails anyway. This paper is a pretty hot take.
I mean, it is a hot take, but basically the argument, in a sense, is that people in some ways are changing, perhaps, how they deal with moral issues based on how it fits with their political beliefs.
Right. Well, and I think to back this up, you just set up like the old paradigm, right? So I think Jonathan Haidt is probably the biggest popularizer of this. And so he has this thing where he says, look, people think about morality along, I think it's 5 axes.
Right.
And one of them is like caring for others, and one of them is about purity and disgust. And he shows that there's a strong correlation between these moral foundations and people's political worldviews. And like you can see in the homelessness discussion exactly
right.
how
yeah.
that plays out. If you're somebody whose primary motivation is about caring for the weak, then you think about this kind of situation in one way. If you have another worldview, you tend more to think, as conservatives do, you worry about the incentives. Well, if I help people who are in a bad situation, does that actually attract more people into the badness, right? And so that's a whole thing.
Yeah, but if you've ever read a story with the headline, like liberals and conservatives' brains work differently or something like
yeah.
that, it's probably either a bastardization of this literature or a bastardization of the bastardization. But that's kind of the direction that it's pointing.
But the hypothesis of this paper is that it's actually the opposite.
So the authors, Peter Hatemi, Charles Crabtree, and Kevin Smith, they did analyses that were based on the American National Election Studies panel from 2008 and a sample of hundreds of Australians, which, you know, that's a lot of Australians. And so basically you give them a moral foundations questionnaire. And what they found is that you couldn't tell based on the score whether or not they were liberal or conservative. But if they were liberal or conservative, you could kind of tell what their answers would be. And so that's a reverse, as Matt said, of kind of what we had been thinking previously. And The Atlantic did a big write-up of this paper. And I think the biggest finding, you know, I think the biggest conclusion a lot of people came to is like, that, you know, you can see this in kind of the age of Trump. But I think that it's something, it was an interesting paper to me because I think what determines your politics or how much your politics determines what you think and how you act morally. I think that that's a really fascinating question.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's, when this literature was really the hot thing in like kind of explaining ideology and political alignment, like 5 or so years ago, it was a very elegant way to square the reality that most children retain the political ideologies of their parents with the lack of wanting to like say that politics is a genetic thing or to kind of reduce any role of free will, right? You don't want to say like, it's not like, you know, if you are not a 100% doctrinaire Marxist and believe that your class position determines everything, it's a little bit hard to say, okay, yes, you as a child may have different beliefs about a lot of things from your parents, but like you're generally going to follow that trajectory unless you can say, well, actually, maybe there is this psychological basis that either is genetic or is, you know, or is like deeply rooted in nurture that structures the way you look at the world. If in fact it's turtles all the way down, which is kind of the implication here, right?
Right.
That it's like there is something else that puts you in a political tribe, and then you adopt the ideas about how the world should work that your political tribe has. And those views evolve as your political ideology evolves, which is the other kind of key finding of this study, that like in different waves of this, your moral foundations in wave two don't predict your political ideology in wave three, but they do predict your political ideology in wave two. So there's evidence that the two of them kind of evolve together and can predict each other. They can predict each other, even though it's pretty clear that moral ideology is not predicting political ideology. But like, this kind of blows up the elegant way of thinking about the genetic, you know, the inheritance question, right? Because it means that there's something else that you're just kind of, you're on team red or team blue, and that determines everything else.
Right.
Which raises very uncomfortable questions about when and whether it is worth talking to people on the other side.
Right. And well, I think that that's something, you know, as that is my job, I think that that it does raise a lot of questions. And I think that, you know, while thinking about this question, there's a ton, you know, I think all of us can come up with a lot of anecdata about like, that's absolutely 100% true about like X entity. But it'll be interesting to see, because I think that this is such a hot take of a paper, as you said, that I'm curious, because I'm just, you know, when I read it, I was like, oh, that makes a lot of sense. But then I'm now thinking about it, it does kind of raise the point of like, how deterministic is this?
Right. I mean, but I think what's interesting, right, is like part of the sort of Moral Foundations project was to try to suggest that we could lower the temperature on political debate by reconceptualizing these things. So like go back to the homelessness, right? Because this was a big, like, this was a hot literature when Bush was president, and it worked on the homelessness question, right? That you can say like, look, we have like a different view of like what exactly is bad about these people living on the streets. But if we can agree that what we are trying to do here is reach a consensus that will get us to a point where fewer of them are on the streets, but also that is a consensus, we can hit upon, right, like housing first, right? A Republican administration, it's kind of soft-hearted, but it's structured to achieve what the tough-minded conservatives wanted. It's all kind of good, right?
I now finally understand the push for comprehensive immigration reform.
There you go.
Yeah.
If it turns out that that's not true, right, that like actually these ethical commitments are downstream of ideological commitments, it means that like, yes, like you can have one-off compromises on low salience topics, like homelessness in the mid-aughts was not the subject of highly polarizing debates. As you're saying on immigration, right, it was easy enough to reach some kind of deal, as long as you have just like some guys in the back room of Congress somewhere working stuff out. But when it becomes a media topic, right, it becomes very, very tough, very hard. And you could say, well, okay, that's like a pathology of how talk radio works or what's on Fox News. But also it's like, look, if actually people's like ground level morality is being shaped by their high level political commitments, then it stands to reason that anything that becomes a major topic of discussion will just repolarize, because people like have different high-level commitments, and you can't quite like work it out that
right
way.
At the point at which you're saying, well, that's a pathology of blank, and the ways you're filling in the blank are the only ways that issues rise to the level right. of public debate and salience, it's not like we have a lower temperature alternative.
Right. And
Eugewalt.
Yeah.
Although
basically.
The other thing is, like, this is not a static thing, right? I mean, and this is kind of where the Trump salience comes in, is the easy example is like, oh, conservatives say they care about purity, but they didn't care about grab her by the pussy. Like, that's the dumb way to put it, but it expresses the very valid point that how conservatives, especially evangelicals, conceptualize the relevant importance of personal behavior and, you know, public policymaking when it comes to sexual morality has changed substantially over the last 20 years. Like, those changes, you know, we don't have a robust theory for how that works coming out of this literature, because the literature is very like, how can we measure this in the populace? But that definitely is kind of an avenue out of this, right? Like, if we can demonstrate that people's moral foundations are shifting as their political ideologies shift, what is driving that?
when are people actually falling out of one political coalition or the other? You know, is it like where are the realignments and breaking points? There are lots of things I would like to assign these authors, even though, to be completely honest, their methodology is fairly high level math, and I am kind of assuming that it's correct. But one of these days, someone who actually knows math is going to come on the weeds and tell me that I'm just totally putting too much faith in science.
Yeah, I think that there is very much of a sense, because I was just thinking, I'm like, well, at a certain point, you know, how far does this go? Like, what, how, you know, what morals are unshapable? You know, are there some, like, what could change? Because, I mean, you know, I deal with conservatives and Republicans all the time. And even when they're talking about, like, a dramatic tectonic shift in how conservatives think about a specific issue, they still put it in, like, conservative right-leaning parlance. So it's sort of, like, sort of works underneath that matrices. And so I'd be interested, like, what are the limits to this? How does it work? And, you know, how the back and forth between these, you know, politics and morality, I feel like it's ever flowing.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
We should probably open it up.
Do some questions. Do some questions. All right. We're going to get somebody has a microphone, I think. All right. We got this guy back there.
Thanks for the discussion. How the big thing about homelessness is, I think the growing homelessness issue is the income inequality that's growing. How does that tie into all this stuff? And also the unemployment rate is never a true number of people who are unemployed or are just smoothing off their spouses or siblings or people who are on disability and stuff. And how does that kind of work its way into homelessness? Thank you.
I mean, what's interesting is that homelessness does not correlate that clearly with the labor market, right? That it's not the case that the Great Recession created a huge spike in homelessness, for example. Even though there were a lot of economic problems associated with it.
Even though it was in some ways, you know, sparked by the collapse of—
Right, but actually that's the thing. Houses became very anomalously cheap. Right. At the same time, people were losing their jobs. The biggest problem, I mean, it is a kind of an inequality problem, except not the inequality between the very, very top and the average, but between average people and people at the bottom. Right. So when you have income levels in a city rise a lot, as they have been in Seattle, right, if you then— you don't need to have lost your job. You just need to have not gotten some new, much better job. And you can fall behind in the sort of rat race to keep up with the rent. You don't have that problem as much in southern areas where housing growth in sort of suburban sprawl has been much more robust. You are, though, starting to see it specifically in Austin, you know, really increases in housing costs. And so it's that just sort of mismatch between what's the labor market doing and what's the supply of houses has been what's driving sort of contemporary increase in homelessness in the United States. And it's very, I don't want to say it's a hard problem exactly, because in some ways, like, it's a very easy problem. Like, we have, you know, you talk about climate change and it's like, how are we going to do transoceanic shipping without diesel fuel? And like, I don't know, right? How are we going to build apartment buildings? Like, we know how to do that. It's just that it really ties in with a lot of, like, people don't want people sleeping in the park, but people also don't want a shelter across the street, but people also don't want, like, a big building blocking their view. They don't want more traffic congestion on their streets. And it's like, something's got to give in a, like, growing society.
Are there organizations or people who are working on this problem of, I think what we really need are high density housing for people with lower incomes, especially in cities like San Francisco and Seattle, and I'm sure everywhere.
Yes. There's you know, a growing network of groups, often called YIMBY, have in their name. There's some great ones, YIMBY Action in California. There's a group called Neighbors for More Neighbors in Minneapolis. So, you know, there's stuff happening. I mean, there's a growing, I think, chorus of people who want to do the right thing. I mean, and of course it's true, right, that these kind of housing supply issues take a while to sort of reach people in the most dire economic conditions. And like, they just, people need money.
Thank you. So with short-term leases, that's both driving up prices and also removing units that people could live in. Can you speak to like policies or taxes that could help go towards?
Like Airbnb, you mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I like, in some ways, the way Airbnb has worked its way onto the agenda, because left-wing people like to complain about tech startup companies. And this, though, gets them into the point where they're saying that, yes, the relative supply and demand of housing units is a factor in housing affordability, which is true, right? When you have people turning over what could be you know, rental apartments and turning them into sort of quasi-hotels, that increases scarcity. So, you know, I mean, I think taxing those units is a good idea in cities that have a lot of them. But also it stands to reason, like, once you are accepting that the housing supply is an important driver of affordability, then you also have to look at regulations that prevent you from building, right? So, you know, I think a smart thing to do is to tax short-term rentals, maybe take that money into affordable housing production funds, but then also look on the regulatory side at, like, well, how easy is it to go build things? You know, individual cities need to look at their economic mix, because having tourists visit can be a real boon to certain places. It's a great way to generate jobs, generate tax revenue, things like that. But yeah, I mean, it can get out of control, particularly if you're not paying attention, right? You can start seeing dwellings vanish.
So I actually live in the Twin Cities, and the radical change in zoning, I think, is going to be really good for our cities. And it seems like in the Southwest that places like Texas seem to have no zoning, and that would be better because you build more housing. But how much of those policy decisions are really designed to protect an ownership stake in housing?
Yeah. And this is an overstatement. You know, people often say that Houston has no zoning, which is technically true. But what that means is that it doesn't have designated separation of, like, residential and commercial uses. It doesn't mean there's no regulation of, like, parking or building size, things like that. And when you're talking about, like, housing scarcity, whether it's Minneapolis or Austin or anywhere else, the issue isn't really have to do with the separation of uses in Euclidean zoning. It's about limits on floor area, things like that. And, you know, it's in part, I think, about trying to protect home values. This is William Fischel's home voter hypothesis. I kind of think that if you talk to people in urban areas, that the concern almost is more simple, and it's about parking and traffic. Where they're not mistaken, right? An apartment building opened across the street from my row house recently, and a lot of people live in that building, and they cars go in and out of the garage. It's not a big deal for me because I don't drive my car very much. And, you know, when your city becomes a place where lots of people walk, it's not a big deal. But like, it's not wrong to say that if there were more people living on your street, there would be more car traffic. You just kind of have to decide at some point, like, what's the overriding priority?
Hi, this is Carol, and I lived in Seattle for 7 years, and I just moved here about a year ago. And I worked a whole lot with the homeless when I was there as a volunteer. And some of the things that I think that they've done right is that they have made some refurbished motels, which have support services on site. And but one real problem with the camps is that we are children are allowed to live in the camps. And there is a place called Mary's Place where a mother and the children can go. A lot of times they don't want to separate from their partner or, you know, the husband. And it's really dangerous to have the children in the camp because there are no, there's really little checking of backgrounds on the people who come into it. You were talking about the ID situation. That's one of the reasons. I mean, they'll say things like, have you ever been a child molester? Nope, sure haven't. Okay, so I'm serious. So, but the other problem, which you brought up in terms of the driver's license, it costs honestly hundreds of dollars for a homeless person to get a driver's license because I help them. And what the reason it costs so much is because to get a license in Seattle, you had to pay off any fines from previous states, okay, before you get your license. And then they also make them that state, and this particular man is from Detroit. Well, Detroit's broke. So they're not going to release the license until they pay a reinstatement fee. And then you have to pay like $125 to do a driving test, but they don't have a car. So then I lend him my car. My husband would have a nervous breakdown. But, you know, we've got this cycle of problems going on. And I think the secret is, if there is a secret, is to have small group support systems. We can't have them going from one building to another building, getting on the bus. And I think if you can break them into like little hubs, then there's going to be some success.
I also think it was interesting that you mentioned kind of talking about, like, you know, they don't want to separate the person from their partner or their husband. I think it's really important that we are talking about homeless family units, like family units where people are making entirely sensible decisions for them that make sense for them. So for example, my mom for a long time was a court appointed special advocate for neglect and abused children in Cincinnati, Pro Kids in Cincinnati. There are organizations across the country, but she dealt with a host of people who were kind of on the brink of homelessness. But, you know, people would ask them like, well, you could send your child away. And they're like, absolutely not. Never. 100% zero. No. And so I think it's really worthwhile when we're thinking about these issues and thinking about, for instance, like children in the encampments. I think that a service that could allow at least mothers and children, ideally families, to stay together and get support services to keep kids not just safe, but also, you know, out of foster care systems, out of the even short-term foster care, which can be extremely risky for children. I think it's really worth thinking about, you know, these are families. These are families like our families. And I think that, you know, how we talk about this and thinking, you know, even using phrases like family unit, it sounds so like, vast and above. When we're talking about families, we're talking about, you know, I've known a host of homeless folks pretty well. And when you talk to them about just like, you know, they're dealing with everyday normal challenges. And I was, you know, Dara mentioned things about like, you know, dropping off like shampoo and stuff like that, but even things like menstrual products and stuff like that, things that people are afraid to ask about, but things that are entirely logical for them to need. I think that, you know, occasionally when we talk about this issue, we want to do so logically, but we're not doing so personally. And I think it's really important to do so and think about how family formation, things that we know are important in every other sector of how we talk about social issues, are still important when we're talking about homeless people.
I'd also say, and I think it's, given how obsessed I've been with this, it's kind of amazing that I took until this long in the episode to say it, but a lot of the stuff that we've been discussing here is stuff that I witnessed firsthand along the U.S.-Mexico border in the last couple of weeks. If you haven't heard our episode from last week on the migrant protection protocols and the camp situation that has resulted on the Mexican side of the border with tens of thousands of migrants, like, kind of being just left to wait,
a lot of this is stuff that I literally saw in Matamoros 10 days ago. So I would strongly recommend going back and re-listening to that with this in mind, that in addition to the kind of broader policy concerns there, there are a lot of like, I literally saw a van come through with a bunch of hygiene, you know, like paper hygiene products and a huge swarm of people, because of course that's not a thing that when you're trying to, you know, keep your family safe and get all your paperwork together for your court date, that you're not going to be able to take care of. So.
Hi. So Austin recently essentially decriminalized homelessness, but Alex Jones and InfoWars have been coming to a lot of the public meetings and kind of creating a lot of disinformation that's, I think, well, okay, we have a lot of squeegee guys, and the squeegee guys as a group, they're different individual people, but they have been here for as long as I've lived here, which is, I'm an Austin native. I'm sure they were here before, but so there's a information issue with, like, I think people moving into Austin and getting wrong information about homeless people. And then also the intentional disinformation of gathering people and going to public meetings and basically creating riots. Now this is going back to city council in a few weeks. So I don't know how many Austinites are actually here, but what do you suggest we do? I live near 35, so I live near a homeless camp. We had temperatures that were like 118 this summer. I was dropping off cold water. Somebody was having medical issues the other day, so I called 911 and waited with them. They're people too. I don't really know what to do.
Are you a writer? Because I would totally, you've laid out a really robust theory of how political and demographic change works, and I would love to read this in long form.
I'm not a writer.
Also, unsurprisingly, I, as a journalist, my answer to a what can we do to fix this problem is I would read about it.
Yeah,
which
do some takes.
Yeah, so I think one of the things, I think the information, something that that exists in DC, and I'm a huge advocate for. So there's a newspaper in DC that's run by homeless DC residents called Street Sense. And that is basically a newspaper entirely about what homeless people are dealing with, stories focused on, like, you know, crimes that happen to homeless people. A really horrifying trend that's been happening lately is, you know, violence aimed at homeless people. We saw that happen in California, where the son of like some wealthy scion set a homeless person on fire. You know, we saw in DC that people, you know, someone killed two people driving into them on purpose. Two homeless people, including one, you know, one guy who'd been living on the street for like 30 years. And so I think in terms of,
that happened here in Austin. Somebody threw, I think, a lit candle or like a lit flare at a homeless camp.
I mean, that really talks about the dehumanization that homeless people experience. But I think a way to counter that and the way to counter disinformation is to, you know, get the facts from homeless people themselves. So often when we're talking about this issue, you know, it's not as if homeless people are super jazzed about being homeless. Like, I think that there's this idea, and I think we talked about that earlier, that, like, you know, these are like antisocial people who are super super excited to be pushing grocery carts, carrying all of their possessions, or dealing with extremely severe mental health issues. I mean, they're afraid all the time. And so I think using the information that they can give us and listening to their stories is really important. And I also, you know, recognizing like why Alex Jones is weaponizing this. Like, this is one, it's, he may be
just good faith disagreement about ideas.
decidedly. Like, this is
because Alex Jones values stability.
It's the moral
foundation. But also the fact that this is going to an audience that's not here. And so much of, you know, Fox News and kind of the far right publications are talking about issues that happen in cities in which the people reading or watching do not live. So you have people who live in like Findlay, Ohio, who are desperately afraid of like something that happened in New York, that they, of a city they have never been to. So I think, you know, the anti-urbanist attitudes that are voiced by Alex Jones and a host of other people are really important to counter, but it's really critical to lift up the stories of homeless people themselves, because I think in a lot of ways they know best like what they need and how best to prioritize it, just as we do.
And they certainly are going to be well-equipped to talk about what's changing.
Right.
if that's kind of, if the concern is this is new or this, we don't know how, like we're trying to make this better and it's not working, people who have actually been on the street and can say, yeah, we haven't seen anything different, right, even though the city says it, that's a very reliable way of gauging the effectiveness of a policy in the short term.
That looks like we're about out of time, but thanks to all of you for coming out here live. Thanks, as always, to folks listening back at home. Email us.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.